This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how to protect the health of your pet in summertime with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll learn about the new discovery of a fat-burning switch with researchers Dr. Lawrence Kazak and Dr. Alba Guarnet. We'll find out about cricket and duckweed farming with farmers Lubo and Kubo Zamba. And lastly, we'll discover how to support our father's mental health with researcher Dr. Aaron McGann. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. New research suggests that intermittent fasting may help people lose weight by changing both the gut and the brain. In a 2023 study, researchers followed 25 adults with obesity in China through a 62-day intermittent energy restriction program. Participants gradually reduced their calorie intake during a controlled fasting phase and then followed a lower calorie eating plan. By the end of the study, they had lost an average of 7.6 kilograms, or about 7.8% of their starting body weight. Researchers also found improvements in body fat, waist size, blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol levels, and liver health. Brain scans showed lower activity in areas linked to appetite and addiction-related behaviors, which may affect cravings and self-control around food. At the same time, the participants' gut bacteria changed. Scientists discovered links between certain types of gut microbes and activity in the brain regions involved in attention, learning, emotions, and decision-making. The findings suggest that weight loss may involve more than simply eating fewer calories. Intermittent fasting may trigger changes in the body's gut-brain connection, influencing how people respond to hunger and food. However, researchers say that larger and longer studies are still needed to better understand exactly how these changes work. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000-square-foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's a frequent guest on this show. Welcome back, Gordon. How are you?
Fine. It's great to be back with you again.
So we've spoken a lot about human gut health and supplements to help with digestion and immune health, but this time you're going to chat about our canine friends and kittens, etc., and why their digestive system is so important. And I'm guessing now that summer is here and our furry friends getting into all kinds of things that they shouldn't be. I know that firsthand. Yeah.
You have a dog, I assume.
We do. And she is not discerning about what she eats. Let's put it that way.
It's interesting when we think about the health of our canine friends, right?
Yeah.
Of our pets, we should realize they live in the same environment as us, and if anything, they're exposed to the same toxins you were exposed to. So a lot of the issues that we have because of the environment and so on also affects them. So at this time of the year, I know we're just coming off from seasonal allergies, right? I don't know if you have them, but I had them,
Yep.
right? And I do know there are a lot of our pets who get seasonal allergies too. And a lot of seasonal allergies, there are many different things that we can do to help with seasonal allergies. One of the first things I tell everybody with seasonal allergies, you should start off by doing a cleanse. A little anecdote. When it's wintertime, I don't have seasonal allergies. I can sit in a smoke-filled room. I have to be out of there in probably about half an hour, but I can sit there comfortably for about half an hour. In the summertime, or when I do have seasonal allergies, I can only sit in there for about 5 minutes. And the reason for that is because my body is so filled up with toxins or with or it's been stimulated by the seasonal allergens that the little bit of smoke or so pushes me over the edge, so I can't tolerate it as well. It's the same thing that's happening with your animals, right? So one of the things that you should do is to do a cleanse, a liver cleanse on your dog or cat, right? I usually focus on the dogs because dogs are easier to deal with than cats, because cats are very picky as to what they will consume or what they won't consume. But with the dogs, you give them do a seasonal a cleanse with them, and that helps get rid of some of the toxins. So then they can tolerate the allergens a lot better. So their reaction is not as strong. All right. Now it's also known that there's a big tie-in with the gut and the immune system. All right. So much so that a lot of people have been using probiotics, right? Probiotics is for gut health, right? But when we talk about gut health, we usually just think of digestion and so on, but we don't think of the immune system with gut health. Well, if you think about it, most of the things that will attack the immune system or attack the body come through the gut, or they come through breathing, right? So through your airways. So one of the ways that we can look at helping gut health or helping health in general, the immune system, is by the use of probiotics. Now, one of the things that probiotics do is that it helps fight off the effects of bad bacteria. Probiotics are also there because they're useful in changing the microbiome of the gut. And when you change the microbiome of the gut, you're basically choosing bacteria there that will produce compounds which are actually beneficial for the gut.
So, Gordon, are there probiotics that we can give our pets?
Oh, definitely. There are lots of different probiotics that we can use. Okay. You can use the Lactobacillus acidophilus, bifidus, and so on. But what I try to tell people about probiotics, there's not one. The probiotics are called good bacteria, and they're only called good bacteria because the body actually tolerates the waste products that these bacteria produce better than the waste products produced by the so-called bad bacteria. But I tell everybody also, if I take one good bacteria, right, for example, Acidophilus, and I went into your body or your dog's gut and take out all the other bacteria and just put this one, you'll have a very sick dog, right? And again, the reason for that is that it's all about balance, right? So you need to have a whole bunch of different probiotics all at once to help. It's you helping balance the microbiome by using all these different probiotics in there. So if you're looking for a probiotic product for your dog, choose one that has multiple strains all in the same product.
What about skin allergies? So, I suffer from eczema. Is there something that pets have that is skin-based?
Again, there's lots of reasons why animals get skin allergies. And I don't call them skin. They show as hot spots and so on. And a lot of that is, it could be some allergen in their food, and it expresses as a symptom, which is an itchy skin, right? Sometimes it could be something in the environment that irritates the skin and causes the skin irritation, causes the itchiness. Or it can be something that they ate, and one of the reactions to whatever it is they eat is skin allergies, right? Again, it's the amount of toxins that you have in your system. This is why even the treatment of skin allergies, it's a good idea to take a cleanse, to do a liver cleanse to help clear out some of those toxins, right? Another approach to treatment of skin allergies would be to increase your intake of omega-3s. And let me explain how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Omega-3s are what we call unsaturated fatty acids. And every single cell in your body, the cell wall, is made up of fatty acids. And the skin is no different from the tissue in the body, the rest of your body. However, if you have unsaturated fatty acids as a big component of your cell wall, it makes your cells more resistant to damage by free radicals. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's attacking the problem from a different perspective. So what you're basically doing is reinforcing your skin to help with the to make it more resistant to free radical damage, right? The fatty acids also do other things. They are one of the they help break up the arachidonic pathway, which will help produce compounds which causes arthritic pain also, right? So that's another reason why you want to use omega-3 fatty acids. It's also important for things like brain health, again, because the tissue in the brain is made, all the cells are made up of fatty acids. And if you have unsaturated fats, as the cell wall, it makes bringing stuff from the outside to inside the cell a lot easier. So there are many different reasons why you want to use omega-3 oils as part of your regimen for treatments of all aches and pains. It's basically to help support the tissue.
So this may be a silly question, but like dosages for our pets, I presume it's different, or do they need different products?
I don't stress, because fish oil are basically food items.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's like asking me if I'm feeding my dog salmon, right?
Yeah.
Is it okay if I give him a pound of salmon, or am I only limited to giving him half a pound of salmon?
Right.
Right? You basically do it within reason, okay?
Uh-huh.
Like, just because unsaturated fats or omega-3s are good for you doesn't mean you should sit down and drink a gallon in one go.
Right.
Because I know if you do that, one of the problems with that is that it'll give you diarrhea, because your body's not designed to handle that much fat in one sitting. So be reasonable. Usually you go with whatever the label says, right? But in all fairness, if you give them a little bit more, give them a little bit less, it is not the end of the world. It's because it's considered as a food item. It is not a drug.
So when we're dealing with these allergies, whether they're topical or seasonal, the stuff that Omega Alpha makes for seasonal allergies, are those okay to give your pets as well, do we need to worry that maybe it can't be ingested by them?
No, it definitely can be used, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do not make a product per se that says for allergies only, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of our approach to things with allergies is a broad systematic approach. So I would say increase your intake of probiotics, increase your intake of omega-3 fish oils,
right?
Mm-hmm. Do a liver cleanse, right? Or even a kidney cleanse. Right, that's one of the things that people don't really think about, the cleansing part of the situation. Right, there are herbs which will actually boost the immune system. So you take antioxidants, stuff like quercetin, etc. is very good for allergies. Right, so it's an approach where you put a whole bunch of different things together to treat the system. Right. Because it doesn't happen. Allergies is a reaction of the body, and it's many different systems in the body that react to produce the allergic response, right?
So,
one of the other things that we probably suggest is do something called a lung tone, which is one of the products we make, but that is to help clear up the mucus and so on. And I know for a lot of dogs who have seasonal allergies, mucus is definitely one of the symptoms that is exhibited by these animals.
Off the top, we were talking about naughty dogs who perhaps get into the wrong food that's, you know, left out in the park. Can you give us a little primer about pet digestion and you know what to look for, etc.?
Well, pet digestion is like human digestion. If we talk about dogs are primarily carnivores, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they do eat some grass and so on sometimes, because everybody's seen their dog nibble on some herbs on the lawn or,
yep,
or out in the park, etc. Right?
Yep.
I think what you're probably asking me with some of these things is that, what if our dog gets into trouble and eat the wrong thing? And we usually don't know what they've eaten to give us. We just know that your dog just does not look right.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
So my first thing on that is always, you know, if your dog looks sick and he doesn't look like too happy, one of the first things to do, run to the vet.
Of course.
Okay?
Yep.
But sometimes running to the vet alone is not going to do the job. What I would always say, give him more probiotics, but not strictly probiotics. You need probiotics with things like fiber and so on, because one of the things that you want to do is to help whatever it is in there pass quickly. And sometimes the dog, if they eat something, you know he gets diarrhea,
mm-hmm,
right? So if you give him probiotics also help with the diarrhea process, help stop the diarrhea, because the diarrhea is a reaction to whatever toxins they have taken. Right.
Yeah.
And with the fiber, if you take something with fiber, right, it helps firm up the stools, etc. Right. So, you know, it's a multiple approach. The product we manufacture for that is Probiotic A Plus. It is just not only probiotics. You take it because it has fiber in it. You take it because it has a lot of trace elements in there from greens and so on that you have in there. It has antioxidants in there. Right. So those are some of the, it's like a one-stop shop.
Makes a lot of sense. All right. So we only have time for one last question. Given the season and the fact that it's warming up, you know, what should pet owners do to sort of protect their loved animals from either allergies or ingesting something they shouldn't? What are your final thoughts?
Well, one of the things is I believe in prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so prevention is, as the saying goes, the answer to prevention is worth a pound of cure. So do a liver cleanse, do a lung cleanse, right? Start off with that and make sure you give your dog probiotics or a probiotic product, right, to keep your gut healthy. And again, most of the times, if they seem to be sickly, you give them an immune booster. Immune booster is one of those things that you can't go wrong by giving it to them. You just end up with a much healthier animal. And that's what you basically would be looking for.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me again, Jamie.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. You already know the importance of exercise for energy, improved strength, and better mobility. What you really need is an expert to show you how to exercise safely. Receive personalized coaching from Fitness Solutions Plus. Learn safe exercises for osteoporosis, diabetes, chronic pain, and balance issues from a fitness specialist. For a free consultation, visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca, number one in one-on-one fitness for adults over 50.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Lawrence Kazak is an associate professor in the Department of Biochemistry and the Rosalind and Morris Goodman Cancer Institute at McGill University, where he holds a Tier 2 Canada Research Chair in Apodicite Biology. His research program focuses on defining the molecular mechanisms by which adipose tissue regulates system energy balance and metabolic health. Alba Guarnet is a full professor in the Department of Biochemistry at McGill University and a Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in DNA transposition. Her research uses structural biology approaches to delineate how macromolecules function at a molecular level in their cellular environment.
Combining structural biology, biochemistry, and genetics, her laboratory has made important contributions to our understanding of how proteins recognize and repair DNA damage. Working with Lawrence Kazak, she is leveraging structural biology to identify small molecules that can accelerate energy expenditure and bone mineralization. Welcome to the show, everybody. How are you?
Good.
Good, thank you.
So, what did your team discover, and why are you calling it a fat-burning switch?
So, we discovered a mechanism by which our cells can burn excess energy. And we're calling it a fat-burning switch because this mechanism is not continuously burning energy. It needs to be switched on through molecular mediators. And we identified one of these mediators to be a small molecule, a metabolite called glycerol, which when bound to tissue non-specific alkaline phosphatase, this protein, it switches on its activity to promote energy wasting in these cells. So that's why we're calling it a switch.
So this pertains to brown fat. Can you explain what brown fat is and how it's different from the fat that we usually think about?
Sure. So the typical fat that we think about is white fat. This is fat that's stored all around our bodies that takes up excess energy from the food that we eat and stores it in large lipid droplets. And this sort of fat is really geared towards storing chemical energy. Brown fat is unique because it can also take up energy, but instead of storing it, it will burn it in organelles called mitochondria within that cell type. And brown fat has specialized metabolic pathways that allow it to take up this energy to burn it. And it has its brown color because of all the mitochondria and the cytochromes that it has within those organelles. So that's why it's actually brown. If you take it out, it's highly vascularized as well to take up all those nutrients. So that's how brown fat's different than white fat.
So your study found that molecule you referenced before, glycerol, can activate an alternative heat-producing pathway. Can you walk us through what happens in the body when we're exposed to cold temperatures?
Sure. So initially, when temperature drops, we have nerve endings in our skin that sense that drop in environmental temperature. And that signals back to the brain, which stimulates the sympathetic nervous system to release a chemical called norepinephrine or adrenaline or noradrenaline. Those are all the same thing. This molecule is released from these sympathetic nerves to activate mechanisms in cells that are geared towards producing heat. So for example, the sympathetic nervous system innervates, means it goes into the brown adipose tissue. The noradrenaline is released, and that noradrenaline binds to receptors. These are proteins on the plasma membrane of brown adipocytes. And it initiates this cascade of events, one of them being the molecule that we discovered, glycerol. Glycerol starts to accumulate to high levels within these brown adipocytes, binds to TNAP, and activates energy expenditure and heat production.
Alba, your team identified what you'd call a glycerol pocket on the TNAP enzyme. How are you able to pinpoint that interaction, and why is it such an important piece of the puzzle?
Well, when Lawrence reached out to me, he had already discovered that glycerol activated TNAP. What he didn't know is how it did it. So he came to me, and what we did then was determining several structures of different variants of TNAP bound to glycerol. And what we did is we grew crystals. We took these crystals to the Canadian light source in synchrotron and in Saskatoon. And then we use synchrotron radiation to determine their three-dimensional structures and at molecular level. And from these structures, we were able to identify where glycerol bound. We were able to identify where glycerol bound. With this information, what we did then was generate mutations guided by our structures. And then we assay that when we did mutations on this pocket, we lost that activation by glycerol of the TNAP function. So that was step number one of understanding how glycerol acts on TNAP. And the interesting fact is that we found that this glycerol pocket is very far away from the active site of the protein. So now what we're trying to do is trying to see how these two pockets talk to each other.
What surprised you most about discovering that the same enzyme involved in energy-burning fat cells also plays a direct role in bone mineralization and bone health, which is like the, I guess that's the abstraction here, right? Like there are real-world implications to your research. Can you sort of tie that together?
Yeah, in hindsight, it's actually not surprising at all. We just happened to study this protein, TNAP, within brown fat. But the most famous role for TNAP is in bone health and bone strength. And so it was pretty clear that once we had discovered this activation mechanism by studying brown adipocytes or brown fat cells as a model system, that we turned to the system where TNAP plays its dominant role, which is in bone health. And I think, so from that standpoint, it's not too surprising. I think what is interesting to think about is how does glycerol access TNAP on mineralizing cells called the osteoblasts in that microenvironment? And that's going to be something that we want to pursue in the future. For example, our bones have bone marrow adipocytes. So there are adipocytes that are close by, and it's very possible that glycerol is released from those bone marrow adipocytes to access the glycerol pocket to promote mineralization. But that's a hypothesis that we want to test in the future.
Well, isn't that the role of the marrow is to produce both red blood cells and to help, you know, grow your bones back? Or I'm not a biologist, but I'm just wondering, isn't that what marrow does though?
That's what marrow does, but this is specifically would be the adipocytes themselves.
Okay, so how it all works. In other words, you're getting granular here, for lack of a better word.
Exactly. Those mineralizing cells, the osteoblasts, are in an environment, a microenvironment, that has not regular adipocytes, but these are by all intents and purposes just adipocytes in that region, right? So it's possible that the glycerol is released from those adipocytes that acts on cells that would have developed from the bone marrow, as you say.
I'm going to mispronounce a word. You can correct me. What is hypophosphatasia? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm not going to say it again. Sometimes described as soft bones. Can you explain what that is and how this discovery might play into treating that?
So hypophosphatasia is a rare genetic disease that leads to defects in mineralization of bones and teeth. People with this disease carry mutations in TNAP, and that's why we're talking about the disease here. And these mutations lower the activity of TNAP, and this is what ultimately causes the mineralization defects. There is no cure for the disease, and the only therapy, which, fun fact, was also discovered here in Montreal years ago, the only therapy available is enzyme replacement. This is an invasive treatment, and it causes numerous side effects over the years. So we're very excited about Lauren's discovery here, because it could provide an alternative treatment avenue. So we, instead of replacing the enzyme, we could now boost the residual activity of the enzyme, and this should be a better treatment for these patients, at least for some of these patients.
Your finding with respect to brown fat, would it extrapolate to the white fat? In other words, is this a trigger for burning energy within white fat as well? Or do you not know that based on the work that you've done?
That would be definitely possible. It would be amenable to burning within white fat if you could alleviate some of the other constraints in white adipocytes. So as I mentioned before, what distinguishes brown fat from white fat is its copious amounts of mitochondria,
right,
and ability to oxidize and burn substrates. White fat doesn't have that basally, but if you can imagine those constraints were released, where you can increase the amount of mitochondria in your white adipocytes, absolutely, we think this mechanism should be able to work in those white fat cells as well.
So where do you see the results of this research going? Like, what are next steps? And, you know, I know it's usually a very long trip between, you know, these discoveries and treatments, but maybe you could map out what the work that you'll be doing and where you see this going.
We're at the beginning of the journey, as you mentioned, and this is a long journey, right? So we first need to understand how the glycerol pocket is functionally connected to the active site. So basically, how do they talk to each other? We're trying to map how they are connected right now, and this will help us understand what patients, what hypophosphatasia patients would benefit from a TNAP activator. Then we need to find mimics of glycerol, if you want, but that are more potent activators of TNAP. So basically, that work even better than glycerol. Once we have those molecules, we'll need to find first if they have any side effects and rule out that they don't have any side effects, and then finding non-invasive ways to deliver them to patients. So this is a long-term project that both Lawrence and I are continuing with some other collaborations, and that we hope that eventually we'll find a molecule that is a very good activator for TNAP. And it's an exciting treatment avenue that ho we hope to be able to offer in the future to hypophosphatasia patients.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie.
That was Dr. Lawrence Kazak and Dr. Alba Guarnet. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to farm crickets on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Kubo Dzamba is co-founder of Third Millennium Farming, a closed-loop urban farm in Mississauga that raises crickets and duckweed and turns them into familiar foods such as sourdough bread and pasta that look and taste like the originals. He also teaches architecture at Humber Polytechnic and leads a culinary research collaboration with Humber chefs developing insect-based ingredients. His focus is making ancestral, nutrient-dense foods accessible again without changing how they taste or feel to eat. Lubo Dzamba is co-founder of Third Millennium Farming and a retired architect. At the farm, he is the in-house duckweed expert, focused on whether a single-ingredient fertilizer like cricket frass and a single-ingredient feed like duckweed can match the yields of multi-ingredient commercial products. Reducing each input to one ingredient is what makes a true closed loop possible. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing great. Excited to be here.
Also doing great.
Excellent. So it's interesting. Both of you, your backgrounds professionally are architecture. How did you get into cricket farming?
It started in my master's of architecture program at U of T, I think probably in 2002 or 2007, something like that. And the assignment was find out how to farm a lot of food on a small piece of land in the city. So urban agriculture, something like a house-sized plot of land. And all of the students, including me, were trying to figure out how to do that, running numbers. And in the end, we had interesting designs, but it turned out, you know, someone tried to do a vineyard and did like 7 bottles of wine a year. Someone did a chicken farm, but ended up with only a few chickens. And I kept playing with the idea of using urban wastes and farming algae, feeding it to insects. And I didn't know how to solve the culinary issue, but the amount of protein and nutrition being produced was like orders of magnitude more, like hundreds, even 2 or 3,000 times more than conventional farming. And so that's when I got interested in it.
So it was a little bit more traumatic, because if you have a father who is a one generation older architect, and you're going to say you're going to grow something in a small lot, you slap him around and you say, are you crazy? You basically say, look, you look at formulas. You start with hunters and gatherers and you figure out how much land supported one person. And they started at 2.8 kilometers square. And then how much you get to a broiler chicken. And when they did that, we were at 9.7 meters. I said, what are the revolutions in between? What kind of reduction of land surface per the sustainability of a person has happened. And we have figured out that all of these revolutions were about 1/10 all the time. So I said, therefore, we have to be 1/10. And what is going to support it? And what kind of a vehicle, what kind of a vector, what kind of a organic vector can support this to grow this much protein?
So yeah, he said exactly what needed to be said. And so then after that project, I kind of worked on it under the radar, looking at exactly the questions that my father Lubo mentioned. It became the subject of my studies, PhD in architecture at McGill University, which I got close to finishing, but never quite got around to. And now it's the subject of the company Third Millennium Farming, where we're trying to make that real.
So off the top, we discussed how your operation is a closed loop farming operation. Can you explain to the listeners what that means for those who don't know?
Well, you started it so well in your intro that I think one of the most unique things that we've been able to demonstrate is the single source ingredient strategy, where the crickets produce this really interesting output called frass. And yes, some of it is cricket poop, this dry sand-like substance, but the shells that fall off the chitin has really surprised us in how useful and intricately it integrates into the other aspects of the biosphere. And so we use that frass to farm as a single source ingredient to farm duckweed. And we produce it at almost commercial levels, where people need a blend of many different chemicals and substances to create these commercial fertilizers. We do it just with this one organic output from crickets. And then we take the duckweed. We have to process it in different ways for different aspects of the farming process for crickets. But basically, as one ingredient, we don't add anything to it. We give it to the crickets as feed, and we achieve yields of crickets that are comparable to the commercial feeds that we used to use for farming crickets. And again, those feeds are made out of a blend of different things, corn-based feeds with all kinds of additives and things like that. And so in using those single source and single ingredient feeds, we're able to close the loop, whereas an operation that has to use a blend of things, if you imagine each of the ingredients in that, let's say, feed, has its own footprint and of production and farming and so on, and every input that goes into that ingredient has also its own footprint, and it's very difficult to sort of, connect the loop, square the circle, and truly connect things unless it is single ingredient, unless you start with that single ingredient aspect. And so we were able to do that, and now we're looking at how we can expand that and plug other organisms into that as well to enrich that idea.
So part of what you do, it's not only the closed loop of using the chitin, et cetera, to grow the duckweed. It's also you're using the cricket, I presume it's being milled into a meal and being used to create bread and pasta, et cetera. So what is the nutritional value of crickets for humans?
Nutritionally, they're similar to meat, to chicken. So if you take, let's say, wet weight or frozen euthanized crickets and you fry them up like shrimp or something like that, you'll get a similar, 20th percentile protein content analog to any other meat. And we can process them, like you said, we do process it by drying it and milling it into a powder, which increases the protein content a lot, some 70%, 70th percentile of protein. So some bodybuilders are interested in it at that point. But there really wasn't any good and tasty foods and ways of integrating it yet. So that was one thing we were looking at. But then we realized that there is some studies already, some respected studies that show the chitin has a strong prebiotic aspect to it, where it can increase the healthy gut microbiome bacteria by 5 point something fold after people have consumed it for a few weeks. And so that's where we kind of formed this ancestral eating theory where, if you look at iodized salt on a store shelf, people see it's iodized, nobody cares, it's fine. We take it for what it is. And that basically stemmed from the fact that humans evolved near areas where iodine food sources were high, near the ocean or certain soil regions. And as we migrated to other places where it was lower, we started to have iodine deficiency problems. An enlarged goiter was the most visible symptom. But there were many, many dozens of other symptoms that were not visible. And by iodizing salt 120 years ago or so and then making it common, we solved that issue. But we also solved all the invisible problems too. And so that was an idea of ancestral eating, where something that our bodies evolved to need and we just through human evolution left it behind, was reintroduced sort of as a hack into salt, and it solved all the visible and non-visible problems associated with that. And chitin from insects has a similar, I think, typology, because we evolved eating insects. Anthropologically, we know this. My friend Julie Lesnick at Wayne State University is a professor there, published a book on it. There's a rich field of research that showing that we did eat things like duckweed and insects in our past. And evolution is kind of like layers of sediment. The longer humans do something, the more opportunity our bodies have to require it. And similarly to iodine, we left insects behind out of our food culture for reasons, right? Civilization moved on. We had better things to eat. Now it's not very appetizing in North America and Europe especially. And that's fine. But our bodies still need, we think, the chitin. And that study is just sort of the tip of the iceberg, showing how it can improve our health and be therapeutic. And so then our strategy follows iodized salt. Let's find foods that we know and love and ways of incorporating insect nutrition into it as a therapeutic in a way that people still love to enjoy it, and they don't have to make any concessions and you know, understand that they're eating insects. It just looks and tastes the same.
Let's circle back to the prebiotic comment that you made. So a lot of prebiotics are sort of like foods that our body can't process as well. So it's like fiber is a good source of prebiotic. Is it that our bodies can't process the chitin, therefore it aids in the bacteria breaking it down, and that's the process that it supports? Is it akin to that sort of thing? Is it akin to the fiber?
The chitin is a fairly still mysterious for us and amazing component of this whole undertaking in here. We're uncovering it around every corner. We are encountering it. So let's go to it. What is it? Chitin is a substance, a polysaccharide, a very complex polysaccharide. It's one polysaccharide which nature makes, which mimics plastic as close as possible, but it's made by nature. You find chitin everywhere. You can find derivatives of chitin in shells of sea creatures,
right.
Shrimp, everything else. Everything what needs to be flexible has chitin. So derivatives of it are everywhere. So we have been exposed to it for millennia. There's no question about it. Now that it becomes a prebiotic. Prebiotic is a chemical which enters your stomach, is capable of fending off all the stomach acids, is capable of getting into your upper intestine, reacting with enzymes and start fermenting. During the journey through the upper intestine, ferments enough that it becomes a food for your biome. That's why it's called prebiotic. It goes to your biome eats it, and biome then produce postbiotics, which are food for your immune system. And that is the miracle of this thing. It's complicated. You can follow it up. You can read about every fraction of this journey. But that's why chitin does the best. Now, what is shocking on chitin? That it doesn't do it only in our stomach, but it does the same thing in a soil as an extremely complex fertilizer and increases the nutrient extraction from soil. The frass, which contains a lot of chitin, because the crickets cast off their shells 5 times over their lifespan, and all of that comes apart into a very fine dust and comes into the poop, which we then sift out and have the frass. Now, the second you have this chitin in the soil, it immediately reacts with the soil biome, with the millions of bacteria. And that reaction actually allows this biome to digest the stuff which normally plant cannot digest from the soil. So when you give it frass and chitin in it, but not just frass, but the chitin is the miracle in my opinion. Once you give the soil that, the soil will give more nutrient than under any other fertilized condition.
Well, fantastic. Well, that's super interesting. I'm glad you came on the show today to explain that.
Oh,
Thank you for having us.
I listen to you every week.
Fantastic. That was Lubo and Kubo Dzamba. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss father's mental health on The Tonic. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Dr. Aaron Magan earned his MA in education and PhD in psychology from Stanford University, completed postdoctoral training in child psychology and population health, and currently serves as an assistant clinical professor at the Yale School of Medicine Department of Psychiatry. He's the founder of ParentingForHumans.com and DivorcingDads.org, which support parents in creating strong, collaborative, and joyful relationships with their children. He's also the founder of Early Alert ME, which prevents suicide among students and veterans. He's been on the show before. Welcome back, Aaron. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Amy. I am well. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So it's Father's Day coming up next week, and I know you're an advocate for father's rights, and I know you feel strongly about a lot of issues dealing with men's mental health. So I thought it would be interesting for you to come on the show and sort of discuss some of the issues that are top of your mind that the rest of us may not be thinking about. Sound like a plan?
Sounds great.
So when we're dealing with men's mental health, and we'll frame it as father's mental health, what are the signs that a dad might be struggling mentally?
There are three kind of clusters of sign. One is change in behavior, right? If somebody used to be one way and then they're suddenly a different way, if they were super social and now they're not at all, if they were kind of quiet and now they're constantly super loud and getting a lot of attention and looking for a lot of attention all of a sudden, these are signs that something is unstable. That's one cluster. And then the other cluster is when people just say things that are obviously concerning, right? I'm super down. I really don't see a reason to get out of bed in the morning or things like that. That's a second. And a third is just if your gut tells you that something's going on with this person, we have very well-developed guts and they're worth listening to. So if you are worried about somebody that you know, it's worth following up on that and assuming that it's likely correct.
If we see that our dads are struggling or a man that we know is struggling, What's one of the best things that we can do to support their mental health?
Talk with them. Bar none, the biggest risk and the best way to reduce risk for anything bad happening, whether it's further deterioration or all the way to a suicide attempt, the best way to intervene there is just to create a connection. And so to go over in a private situation or send a text message and just say, hey, I noticed that blah, 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 whatever it is that you noticed, I just want to check in and see how things are going. It's as simple as that. And even if they say everything's fine, you know, thanks for asking, then great. And then you can check in with them maybe a few days later again and just signal your interest and signal that the door is open for talking. So I would say that the formula is state your observation, right? I noticed that you haven't been coming to jiu-jitsu for the past 2 weeks. I miss seeing you. Is everything okay? Right. So you state your observation, state your care for the person, and then ask how they're doing. Accept their answer, whatever it is. But then clearly signal, you know, I'm here, happy to talk whenever you want. And then be that guy who keeps checking in. Don't forget about them. Right. Just check in periodically to see how they're doing.
So with Father's Day coming up, I expect to get some sort of cooking utensil for my kids because I spend a lot of time cooking, whether it's grilling or making pastas or things like that. So I know what I'm getting. But if we wanted to give a gift for a father on Father's Day that would support their mental health, what would you recommend?
What a great question. Again, social connection is the answer to a lot of challenges that people experience, especially because men often have a hard time connecting socially and meaningfully. And so if you can help a dad get out and into society and do fun things while doing it, that's ideal, right? So maybe you get them a gift card for some whitewater rafting if they're into that, or, you know, a trial membership at a place that, you know, offers the kinds of things that they enjoy, but it's basically stuff that will get them out of the house, moving and doing it with other people. And if you can't think of any of those things, then maybe just something that gets them with other people, right? Maybe you get them a, I don't know, a card for a karaoke party with friends or whatever that may be. But if you can combine these elements, getting out, moving, and socializing, these are ideal things to support mental health.
And beyond Father's Day, because if somebody's experiencing difficulty, you know, it isn't just about sort of addressing the issue on one day of the year. What would you say? What would you say if you want to help somebody beyond Father's Day?
Yeah. So one is, like I was saying before, to be that person who's actually checking in regularly, right? And it's not that you're their therapist, but presumably you're their friend, or maybe you're their brother, and you care about how they're doing. And so I would not shy away from just putting it in my calendar, right? Every Wednesday, 6 p.m., check in with Anthony, see how he's doing, right? Literally that. And then he can send a text message or a phone or whatever. Ideally, you meet with them in some kind of a regular interval. And when this happens, checking in with them meaningfully. And then if you feel like they need more support, because it shouldn't be all on you, then suggesting that gently, again, sharing an observation, you've been seeming really down for the past few months, you know, who are you connecting with anyone about this or getting any kind of support? And then there's all kinds of options for places to get support. Socializing with other people is a great start. Sometimes there are faith-based groups in the area or support groups that exist. A therapist, starting with your primary care provider and asking for ideas. There are all kinds of options, but being someone who encourages them to connect with support and encourages them to get out of the house, move, and socialize on a regular basis.
So these are good ideas. And I believe that it kind of represents one side of the equation. But I think men have been socialized to be stoic. You know, like in The Sopranos, Tony Soprano keeps talking about the strong, silent type, the Gary Cooper type, right? Which, of course, he is not. But what if you're trying to help somebody, you're asking those questions, but they're not engaging you, or they're not receptive to ideas of getting help? What would you say in those circumstances?
I think one of the strongest instincts that we have as dads is taking care of our kids and making sure that they're okay. And I think being able to link a father's well-being to the kid's well-being in a way that the father understands is really powerful. So to say something like, you know, in order to be there for your kids, you need to be well, right? Physically, emotionally, mentally, you need to take care of yourself. And especially younger kids, they can really sniff out really quickly what's going on. You can't pretend to be happy around them. And if your dad is miserable half the time, that's a big drag on your own wellness as a child, right? And so even if we come at it from, this is something you can do for your kids, that can be a really strong motivator. And to say, do you think your kids might appreciate having you around, being more energetic, happy, vibrant, less stressed, healthier, whatever it is, right? That's often such a strong motivator for parents.
Let's talk about some ways that men can manage their stress on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, some of them I think are intuitive. We kind of lean into it. We know it sort of allows us to decompress. But what are some ideas you have? And then maybe I'll add some if you don't reach the ones I'm thinking of.
Sure. Maybe I'll start a little conceptual and then I'll go into really specific things. So conceptually, I really think it's about managing our energy, just how much energy we have. And if we become depleted, the world is a terrible place, right? And when we have a lot of energy, we can deal with a lot of stuff. And so as I see it, we manage our energy using three types of activities. We have escape activities, where we just kind of check out from whatever is stressful, but it's not really improving anything, right? So this is like scrolling on your phone.
Yep.
And then we have recharge activities. And these take some effort, but when we do them at the end, we feel better. Mm-hmm. So this may be something like For some people, this is exercising. Not everybody gets recharged by exercising or yeah. doing some kind of a group community activity or cooking or, you know, something that's fun for you to do. Mm-hmm. So those are recharge. And then the last type is a growth activity where we actually improve our ability to deal with the world, right? So maybe, for example, if money is a constant stressor in your life, maybe you actually spend time taking a class on financial literacy or planning for retirement, if that's a stressor or something like that, right? So it's not particularly fun. It's a fair bit of effort. But when you're done with it, you're actually better prepared for life. Life is less stressful. So you sort of increase the capacity of your battery, I guess, in this analogy. So escape, recharge, growth. And I think that being intentional about having these kinds of activities in our lives is a great way to manage our energy and to manage our stress. And even different escape activities are, some are better than others, right? Like for me, watching videos turns out to be not good at all.
Right.
It kind of pauses life, but then I get back into life. I'm a little more tired and nothing improved, right? Whereas it turns out that reading, I feel better by the end of reading, and listening to stand up is excellent. It's just a pause, but I just feel a little bit better by the end. I'm not tired after just listening to stand up. So you can even pick among escape activities that work. And then when you have enough energy, maybe you start scheduling recharge activities. I'm a big fan of scheduling, right? So if you like cooking and you sign up for a cooking class and it's every Monday evening and it's just happening regularly, every Monday you're increasing your energy a little bit. So that's the conceptual framework, escape, recharge, growth. As far as specific things to do to manage stress, one, first and foremost, get enough sleep.
Yep.
By far, I've come to believe this is the most important predictor of stress, right? When I'm sleeping enough, the world is fine. And when I'm not sleeping enough, the world is a terrible place.
Yep.
So get enough sleep. Number two, when you see a stressor coming down the road, you know that on, you know, Thursday, you have this like a meeting that's probably going to be very upsetting or something like that. Schedule something to recharge you immediately after, intentionally. Mm-hmm. Like go on a walk with a friend that you like, or go do something that gives you energy. So schedule reactively, but looking ahead in your schedule. And then third, like I mentioned before, regularly schedule in your calendar things that give you energy, including social contact, right? So find your two good friends and make sure that you're actually on kind of a rotation and you're talking every Thursday evening, you hang out every Saturday morning once a month, or you know, whatever you can do. So these are the three really concrete things that I would suggest starting with. Did I hit any of yours?
You did. I think those are all excellent ideas. The one that comes top to mind for me is I work out 5 times a week. And for me, it's meditative because in order to do my reps, in order to get through like a HIIT program, in order for me to lift my weights and do it properly, I have to totally focus on what I'm doing. And when you're totally focusing in the moment, your mind isn't racing, you're not ruminating. And I combine it at the end of a workout with sort of holding my stretch poses for 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, and even counting those seconds out is almost like a mantra, which again, I can tune out the world for an hour and a half a day, which I think is a luxury. But for me, it's what allows me to cope with the stress because I get energy after, it helps me sleep, it helps me interact better. So for me, it ties into all those things that you discussed.
Yeah, amazing. And there's no question that moving is good for us on all levels, right? Moving is as good as medication for mild and moderate depression, for example. It's amazing. I think, so this is kind of in the recharge and growth. It kind of hits all the categories, right?
It does.
Escape, it's a recharge and it's a growth.
Yep.
And I think that's amazing. And I would say for people who don't have the time or the energy reserve yet to do this kind of exercise, just do what you can, right? Build up the energy to do a little bit, and then that'll give you energy to do more. And then you can just keep on this kind of virtuous spiral. But I think what you described sounds amazing.
Fantastic. Well, happy Father's Day, and thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Happy Father's Day.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Dr. Lawrence Kazak, Dr. Alba Guarnet, Lubo and Kubo Zamba, and Dr. Aaron McGann. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contest prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.